Welcome, everyone. Good afternoon. Welcome to the day after. Yeah, all those campaign commercials are finally over. The debates are done. But for us political junkies, it's not that easy to let go. We got to talk about what happened, why it happened, and what it's all going to mean. And that's what we'll be doing for the next hour here on Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Woolforth. I'm going to be your host. I've got some really interesting guests. My disclaimer is that I'm a washed-up politician myself, a Democrat, been involved with Democratic candidates, and so if you hear me being biased, that's your cue to call up and challenge me on it. But I have some guests who hopefully are going to be, if not biased, at least give different perspectives, and we'll have some call-in guests during the course of the hour. And we're all going to pitch in on trying to figure this whole thing out. In the studio with me today is Representative Eric Croft, served 5 terms in the Alaska House of Representatives, ran for governor, ran for mayor, well known to people in Anchorage. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And Senator Liesl McGuire, 3 terms in the House, finished a term in the Senate, was just reelected last night or yesterday to the Senate and going back, and I'm sure getting ready to help organize and everything else. Welcome, Senator McGuire. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, this was one of the wilder and stranger elections in Alaska history after so many extraordinary elections that we've had over the years. And we're going to have a number of different guests with us today to talk about what happened on a state level, what happened on a national level. And
you know, I think I'm hoping
each of you will pitch in on that.
But in some ways, it's like, I don't know, the Wizard of Oz, we went to the strange, wonderful land, and now we're back in Kansas again. We're going to have, I guess, Lisa, Don, Sean, and a roughly similar-looking House and Senate. So it was a strange ride, but it got us kind of back to the same place.
Well, I mean, we have results that show Lisa Murkowski with a 5 or 6 percent advantage, assuming
do you all know of those are votes, Lisa votes?
Assuming all those votes actually do get properly counted, we have obvious win for Governor Parnell, right. And Meade Treadwell as Lieutenant Governor, and we have an overwhelming win for Representative Don Young over Harry Crawford, and so continuing, I guess, a Republican tradition in those offices, in the state Senate. We again have a 10-10 split, which is interesting that it goes that way. And then the House, I guess the Republicans picked up a couple of votes, but no huge change.
You want to give us late-breaking news
on
the
happening,
Senate, or if it's confidential?
Well, the Senate is organizing today. We're trying to put together a group of folks. Obviously, it's going to be a coalition by definition, because you've got a 10-10 split again. And it is interesting. You're right. This has now been in effect for the last, it'll be 5 years, and not exactly reflective of what we're seeing in the straight Republican ticket at the federal level. Although I want to point out one thing. The Lisa Joe Miller race, the Lisa Murkowski Joe Miller race, highlighted what I think you see is that fractioning between the Republicans that I have felt for 10 years. And I think in the end, the moderacy won out. And then that although you do see a straight Republican ticket, truly it's the moderate, more fiscal conservative Republicans that sit in that middle that won yesterday.
Interesting, yeah. Well, I want to welcome Senator Mark Begich to the show. He's on the line with us from Washington, and I'm sure he'll have some point of view on that Senate race as well. Thank you for being with us, Senator Begich.
Absolutely. Hope the day is going well for you today, and it sounds like not a bad show to have a recap the day after.
Yeah. No, I think it's going to be fun, and we've got Senator McGuire and Representative Croft here in the studio. I heard President Obama's press conference this morning. Obviously, a 60-seat turnover at least in the House. Also, a lot of lost seats for the Democrats in the Senate, and a lot of discussion about, well, does this mean repudiation of what has been happening the last 2 years, or does it just mean a bad economy? And and I wonder, that the spin is a tricky one, I would think, for Democrats, because you can't really discount what the voters had to say. I mean, what's your feeling on it on a national level?
Well, I don't think there is any spin. The voters have spoken. They're keeping politicians on a very short leash in the sense of they want results. 2 years ago, President Obama got elected. Democrats controlled the House and Senate. They weren't going to give us more than 2 years, that's obvious, on a problem that has occurred over the last 10. They want this economy turned around. They want jobs created. They want investment in public infrastructure. They want things to happen. And what's happened is the 2 years down the road, the results weren't what they expected or wanted, and they now have another trial period, and this time it's Republicans in the House, control the House, and they'll have a responsibility to help govern. They can't just sit around and say no like they've done the last 2 years. It's a partnership to govern this country, and especially the economy and how we move that forward. So, but I would also just kind of put a caution out. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or Democrat. This cycle, the Republicans won the House and picked up seats in the Senate, but now they're on a trial period, and the public is on a very short, they're keeping politicians on a short leash in regards to getting results, and that actually creates a great challenge, especially in Congress. That means people actually have to stop bickering and stop campaigning for the next cycle. Last night, if you heard toward the end of the commentary all night long, was, okay, the 2012 elections have already started. You know, the public is kind of fed up with that. They want you to get busy and govern. And I think that's what you see kind of on a national level. In the local Senate race, I think you saw going into the weekend before the election a sizable amount, doesn't matter who poll, Helenthal, Dittman, people nationally, 12 to 20% undecided. They were waiting to make a decision because their ultimate goal was to be Joe Miller. People were nervous about kind of Joe Miller's agenda and what that would mean from a federal end back to the state. And they were trying to figure out where to go. And I said last week, I said, Scott McAdams will get 24-25% or he will win. It's that simple. And
So do you see, I mean, is this a, you mentioned, I think, in an interview last week or over the weekend that there was a Sarah Palin versus Lisa Murkowski, a grudge match. I mean, do you count this as a knockdown for Palin and Lisa is up there holding her fist high, or do you think we can read it that way?
I think it's a double. I think it's, you know, what it says is Alaskans reject Sarah Palin's politics and her style of politics, and that they reject her, you know, she quit on us. And one thing Alaskans aren't interested in is a quitter. And I think what you saw is people who supported Scott McAdams, people who supported Lisa Murkowski, basically said, you know, we're going to go in a different direction. 65% of the people said no to Joe Miller. The thing I'd point out, too, which is interesting, and this is why I know people weren't sure if they were going to hang on to Scott or if they were going to go to Lisa. And even though, if you look at all the polling data, Scott McAdams has the higher positive rating than all the candidates in the Senate race. But when you look at Ethan Berkowitz's numbers, I think he was around 76 or 77,000 votes. And then you look at Lisa's, which was around 81,000. What that meant is if people just kind of stuck with the traditional voting patterns that we've seen in the past, Scott McAdams probably would have won that race. There's no question in my mind. But people were nervous. They weren't sure, you know, if he could make the win. And what this number tells me is very simply, if people were to stuck with their traditional voting patterns, no question in my mind, Scott McAdams would be today the new U.S. Senator.
But let me push back a little bit on what you said about Joe Miller. This is a guy who was polling in the mid to upper 30s at the beginning of the race, and he ended up at 34% after having what most people would say was an extraordinary meltdown with a huge number of negative things happening to him in the media. What does it mean that, you know, 34% of the public were still with Joe Miller?
Well, I think there's a heart, but also one other thing I want to put in there, if I could, Charles, and that is the low voter turnout. If you look at that right now, it's estimated, I think, around 40-41%. Traditionally, that's pretty low for a governor's race year. And I think what you're seeing is there's a crew of people that were not going to vote for Lisa Murkowski under any circumstances, clearly as a Republican, clearly was not going to vote for any candidate that's a Democrat. So what you end up with is a situation where they go to their likely candidate, in this case, Joe Miller. Now, what people didn't like, and you could see it, people didn't like the personal attacks on Joe Miller. And so now you're in this situation where people are saying, okay, who am I going to pick? And they ended up you know, in this case, picking Lisa Murkowski, and a percentage stuck with Joe Miller. And I can't remember right offhand, but I think it was around in the original race, he got the primary, he got like 55 or 56,000 votes, raw numbers. And I think he got around 67 or 68,000 this time. In the
you've always had a great memory for numbers.
Yeah, I think that's a rough number.
Yeah, that's right.
What was interesting, why I looked at these numbers, I've been looking at them today. First off, the total turnout in raw numbers, I can't remember the number. It's a little over 200,000.
199,000 for the Senate race.
Liesl and I are trying to check you. We have the numbers here, but you haven't screwed up yet. Yeah,
you're doing good.
It's 130,000 less than who voted 2 years ago. Hmm. That's significant.
I wonder if a lot of that negative advertising drives that down.
I think, you know, this year I have to say, and that's why I would bet if you did a post-primary, post-general election positive, negative rating on Joe Miller, Lisa Murkowski, Scott McAdams, I'll put money on it, will have a higher positive than those two, because those two from primary day, and actually pre-primary, but really primary day to general, Lisa and Joe went after each other with, you know, bludgeoning each other to death.
Yeah. Let me turn it over to Eric. I think Eric has a question for you.
Well, we started with this idea of it looks similar to what we had before. Possibly have Lisa going back and Don Young going back. But I guess I wanted your idea, Senator, on whether they're going to get their old positions or something like them back. I mean, I don't know what happens with Don or Lisa. There's too many variables for me to figure it out. But you got any prediction on where they go?
Well, it's a great question. I think, first off, in Don's case, if you remember, he was stripped of his seniority and all his ability. He's no big fan of the person who wants to be the speaker. They've run into, you know, back and forth. Now, it's a flip. I think, you know, Don is a survivor. I called him and left a message today congratulating him. And I think what his ability will have to be is not be irrelevant. And what I mean by that is their margin is so big that your vote becomes marginalized, and you got to be very careful about that over there. But I know Don, he's not going to be irrelevant in the sense of making his voice heard. The question is, will he be in those leadership positions? They're going to, if they're smart about it, just my own, you know, if I was sitting in their room and their caucus, I'd say, you know, everyone, all of everything before November 2nd is forgiven and forgotten. We now move forward because they have to govern. They don't get a choice. See, on that side, they got to do the appropriation bills. They got to do the budget on the budget. They have to do. They have to do the debt ceiling. So they got a tough call. Now, on the Senate side, the way the Republicans work is they have rotation based on so many years, and then you rotate out of chairman's or ranking member positions. But they also move people around in order to be advantageous for the leader. And what I mean by that is Scott Brown, who's only been there less than a year, is already a ranking member of one of the subcommittees or committees, because they want to make sure, because he's up in 2 years as a special election, that he's protected. So it's hard to say. On the Energy Committee Republicans voted prior to the election for Lisa Murkowski not to retain her position. The caucus in total said, no, we're not going to do that. So that's going to be a battle. And then you're going to have the Tea Party group, Rand Paul and some others, who don't like the fact that she beat one of their guys. So I don't know.
Well, yeah. Right. That was a good analysis.
Let me throw it over to Liesl. Yeah. She had a question.
Thank you. Hi, Senator Begich. Liesl here. Question for you. For the 34% that came out to vote for Joe Miller, a group of Alaskans clearly angry at what's happening in Washington, D.C., is there any appeasing that group? You represent those Alaskans as well, and I'm sure you've thought about this. Is there any appeasing that group of Alaskans?
Yeah, if I can broaden it first and say, Liesl, that I think that everyone's mad and frustrated. Doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican. They're just different degrees, I guess.
Yeah.
They have a higher intensity of frustration and anger toward Washington, or the lack of Washington to do their job. Now, I would argue that we've done a lot of things. You know, you guys, especially Liesl, I want to thank you from the work you did with the stimulus and helping us get that money out, get those jobs created with that. But they don't see that as constructive. You know, the $2 billion that have been brought to Alaska through my vote for the recovery money, the only vote of the delegation, you know, they don't see that as a value. Now, I think there is a way, and it's two-part. One, there's a certain part of the Tea Party group that you're never going to fully satisfy them because they're just, you know, they are who they are. They just don't like government. Government shouldn't be doing anything. They'll leave us alone on every element, even getting rid of Medicare, getting rid of Social Security. I mean, if you heard Rand Paul, those are kind of his positions, and Joe Miller. But putting that aside, within the Tea Party, I truly believe this, that there is a high percentage that are just frustrated. They want us to show that they're getting results for the dollars they put down as their tax dollars, hard-earned dollars, that they're getting results, and that we run a much meaner, leaner machine in Washington, and that we do what we can to lower taxes on middle-class Americans. I think that is, and get this economy back on track. I think that's what, there's a subgroup within the Tea Party that we have to hear and heard their message. And I think we need to do that. It doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican. I think those that don't do that are going to face some high consequences. That's why I say the Republicans may be happy today, but now they have the trial period.
And
the public is, you know, they're chewing and they're looking for results. And if they don't like it, you're going to be chewed up the next cycle.
The pendulum swings.
Yeah.
Well, it's swinging harder now.
And faster,
And faster. I guess faster would be the better way to say it. It's faster, and that's why they got to, you know, the public spoke, and any politician, I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican, sits around and says, geez, I think they didn't know better. That person's going to lose, okay? Whoever says that, they're out.
All right.
The second piece is you have to acknowledge that the public is frustrated with the way the business is being run on many levels, and I have to say on many levels, not just federal, but state and local, that they're getting frustrated and they want to see some things get done. They believe we can do better than what we're doing.
Final quick question for you, Senator. The earmark issue. We've heard Bonner talking already about getting rid of earmarks. It's a big Tea Party concern. Does that, if that happens, and I guess what's the likelihood, and how does it affect Alaska?
Well, it could affect Alaska significantly. Personally, I don't care what he says on earmarks. I'm not supporting any reduction of earmarks. Earmarks are a very small percentage of the budget. It's our opportunity, just as the legislators know, Liesl and Eric, they know exactly that that's, you do a capital budget. That's how you represent your districts. There's projects you hear about that through the state bureaucracy never get in, and the same thing happens on the federal side. There's lots of projects that the federal government doesn't deliver on, and we have to make sure they're part of the end product. Now, saying that, I think there is a responsibility we have to ensure that we're doing the right thing and bringing those projects online, getting, you know, rational projects, not some of these. And I agree there, you know, why the Tea Party people, and generally lots of people are upset, is because some of these projects, you scratch your head and say, where did these come from? And what we should be focused on, and this is kind of my own personal view, we should do the transportation bill, which is a six-year road and transportation bill that's critical for long-term infrastructure rebuilding this country, especially in Alaska. We should get a bill called WERDA, which deals with water and sewer projects and Corps of Engineering projects. These are good jobs bills, good hardcore, and they're long-term. That's where we should focus. And yes, we'll probably have some Alaskanized tweaking on there. If the House goes that direction and says no earmarks, we're going to be at risk, and a lot of our infrastructure needs those dollars.
Well, thanks so much for being with us today. I appreciate it, and I know it's later there, so I guess you'll probably get it off for dinner. We very much appreciate having you with us today.
Okay, have a good one.
Thank you. That was Senator Mark Begich. My name is Charles Woolforth. With me in the studio are Representative Eric Croft and Senator Liesl McGuire. The show is Hometown Alaska, and your calls are welcome. We have a lot of guests today, so we'll be squeezing your calls in here and there, but we do want to hear from you, especially callers who want to tell us why they voted the way they did and what they intended to express with that vote. Each and every one of us has a different reason, and so when you hear these pollsters talking about, well, the public wanted this or the public wanted that, it's all just speculation, and everybody out there has an equal voice in that. So the number here is 550-8433. That's if you're within Anchorage. From outside of Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. You can also send us an email at hometownalaska@ksKA.org. And we welcome all of those ways of reaching us. Now, something that Senator Begich raised that I thought was really interesting, and Senator McGuire, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, is this low voter turnout. I hadn't really noticed that, but 41% in an election in which many, many millions of dollars were spent. Even the candidate for Senate only got 25% spent over $1 million. Well, how do we explain that?
I absolutely agree with his assessment, and I could feel it in the final couple weeks when I was going door to door and talking with neighbors. I mean, people were just tired of it. The negativity that was coming, emanating from the airwaves and the TV, it was the robocalls even started to get negative. So people would be in the middle of supper, you know, and interrupted with this sort of negative message. So I think people simply voted with their feet the other way. It's true that it was the first day of any significant snowfall, and we do know that weather affects people. The morning was treacherous for sure in terms of driving, and that's a factor. But I really do believe, as the senator said, that the public was simply disappointed in the negativity, and they didn't want to reward anybody in that process.
Mm, yeah.
I wonder if it was nationwide that the voter turnout was low. I mean, this another thing this was the most expensive race in history all across the nation. And I think Liesl's right that you can just overload people, particularly on negative campaigning, which studies show is effective, but it also drives everybody's enthusiasm.
Yeah. I want to bring in another guest now. We have Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell with us, who is the man in charge of the elections, at least until our new Lieutenant Governor is sworn in. And I want to thank you, Lieutenant Governor Campbell, for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Charles. Good talking to you.
It's great talking to you again. And in the studio, we have Senator Liesl McGuire and Representative Eric Croft, who will probably have questions for you as well.
So we're blaming you for the low turnout. Why'd you do that?
That's right.
Come on now. I get blamed for everything.
That's right.
The weather, too.
That's Lieutenant Governor is maybe the toughest job in Alaska.
Sure.
Anyway, the big question on everybody's mind is, when do we find out who our U.S. Senator is, and what is the process that you go through to do that? Can you run that down for us just briefly?
I'll quickly, towards the end, the certification date that we're targeting right now for the election done by the certification board is the 29th of November. Have to have everything done by the first part of December. So that we, I think the last date for anybody that wants to take it to court is like the 3rd or 5th of December. So certification will be the 29th of November. But to get there, we got a long process, and we're going to start on the 9th of November with all the absentee ballots we received up to that date. And we're going to count all of those. We're going to turn around the next day on the 10th and the 11th and maybe into the 12th, and we're going to take all the write-in votes that were cast yesterday and decipher what the name is of the candidate that people wrote in for each of the write-in ballots. And that will be done about, hopefully by the 12th. And on the 17th, we'll do the last count, which is the last date for absentees to come in. We'll finish with the absentee ballots. And at that point, we'll have time to organize it, quantify it, and get it to the certification board for certification.
Now this is, I believe, the first time this has ever happened in Alaska on a statewide basis that the write-in line has been the winner. And it raises all kinds of questions. And I guess the first one that occurred to me was, you've got a canvassing board or a number of poll workers who are going through these and reading the name and determining what the name is on the ballot. And there will be misspellings, there will be bad handwriting. How is it determined if it's a proper vote or not?
Well, you do have that right, Charles. The canvassing board, which is bipartisan and done in public, so the candidates get to have observers, the parties get to have observers, the press will probably be there when we're doing this, so it's a very public process. But those that are counting the ballots, they will look at each one. If it is spelled exactly right, it will, without probably contest, be counted. But if it has a misspelling, they'll have to look at it and try to determine voter intent, because the law does have, from the federal law on making sure you don't disenfranchise voters right through the state law, voter intent is important. If those who are doing the canvassing and counting agree that the intent is matching to whatever name they believe it should be, they'll count it. If they disagree or believe it does not, they will not count it. Some say that's a subjective process, and to maybe some degree it is, but by having it bipartisan, have it open, have it the ability to question to their supervisor, and including possibly the Department of Law if needed, the discussion is really to try to make sure we don't disenfranchise voters and to determine how if it it's reasonable that what was written in really does match the intent of a name that was qualified. And now, what really complicates it, it could possibly complicate it, is last Thursday, of course, about 160 people showed up to sign up as writing candidates. So it's not just one or two names. And there's a plethora of names in a large volume of numbers of writing candidates that have to be checked against. So this will take a couple days to be done.
I looked at that list. There weren't any, I didn't see any M's, I guess, and no leases. So if Fagan was trying to get close, I don't think he got very close. Did he get one?
One Lisa.
One
yeah.
Lisa, okay.
One Lisa.
Well, it, from the point of view of the individual who's looking at that ballot, they presumably have a Lisa Murkowski representative looking over one shoulder and a Joe Miller representative looking over the other shoulder. And if there's any ambiguity in that count, presumably there you've now got a challenge ballot that will have to be discussed, taken before the board, and potentially litigated. Is that the way it works?
And that's why the observers are there. They certainly can take notes, and if they don't believe that the canvassing board has done it properly, they have the right to protest, eventually take it to court.
But there isn't any question, right, that if they spell Lisa Murkowski all correctly but don't fill in the oval, that's not a vote. That is, wasn't even counted in the first pass.
That's correct. The vote that you see, the number that you see, is from the AccuCount system, and that only counts the ovals that are filled. That's the official number. So if the oval wasn't filled, those have already been put to the side as votes that weren't counted.
Mm-hmm. And has that been decided by a court case, that those pool of leases with no filled-in oval just are not legal votes?
I don't have the court history right in front of me.
I don't know. But anyway, we're pretty sure those don't.
Yeah, those aren't being counted.
That AccuVote system is pretty accurate, I believe.
Oh, yeah. We think, in fact, the accuracy is really not challenged. And what's going to be the challenge to make sure we do it properly is you have a number of how many of the votes were counted by AccuVote. Now, when you do the manual count of the names, the total of that number needs to add up to the same number that was counted by the machine. If it doesn't and you have a discrepancy, you have to go back manually and determine, did the machine count them all right? Or did we not count the ones properly that we manually counted?
Mm-hmm. What if somebody wrote in Senator Murkowski?
Or Liesl Murkowski.
Yeah, there you go, Liesl. But what if they wrote in Sen period Murkowski, Senator Murkowski?
It'd just be up to the person reading it,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I'd leave that to those who are picking up that ballot and making the judgment call with the supervisor within the Division of Elections.
It's going to be interesting.
I've heard Lieutenant Governor Campbell say very clearly he's not going to take any hypotheticals.
Yes, I like it.
So I wasn't even going to try it. One last question for you as you head out the door as our Lieutenant Governor, sort of on the busy side of the job. Are there ways? Is there a better way to do this? I mean, this has been such a crazy whole thing with people flooding in to sign up to be write-ins. And I mean, have you looked at this election process and said, "Well, this needs to be changed," or are you satisfied that democracy seems to be working?
Well, one of the observations, I've talked to our division director of elections, and I've actually just this morning talked to the lieutenant governor-elect, me Treadwell, and I said, you know what, I think. I don't know what happened in 2000 as to why the law was changed to say if you're going to be a write-in candidate, you have to be certified by the state later than five days before the election. That clearly has caused a lot of confusion. If you now are requiring write-ins to be certified and those who aren't certified can't be counted, and once you certify them, making poll workers have to be aware of who's certified and who's not, in case there's somebody that has a question for assistance, you really have kind of complicated it. And I've not done a lot of research on why the law was changed in 2000, but I think we need to look at going back to write-ins are write-ins. The state doesn't need to be involved in write-in issues. People who want to write in a candidate or a name should be able to do that, filling in the oval and writing a name, and then we should have to count it. And that would take away kind of the impression that, well, the state made me certify, so now there are only certain write-ins that can count and those that won't. And I'm a voter, and I want to make sure I vote for somebody that actually counts, and I got to know that. And now I got a list, is it spelled right or not? Just the whole plethora of questions, I think, has come from the fact that we're requiring people to register with the state if they're going to be a write-in.
It would be a really interesting question if somebody refused to register and then won a election.
Right.
Would you really say they weren't the
absolutely
whatever representative?
I agree completely with that philosophy. That's why I've been talking about it. And I think Mead will spend some time thinking about it also, because we probably need to go back and look at what we did in law, and now we see the consequence of that type of law, and we probably need to tweak that.
Well, thanks so much for
remove it.
Right. Thanks so much for being with us, Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell, and thanks for your service as you leave.
Hey, thanks, Gerald.
Move on.
It was good serving with you on the assembly. You take care.
Likewise. So long.
Bye.
Well, the time is now 2:30. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a moment with more of Hometown Alaska.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. A copy of Hometown Alaska will be available this afternoon on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
And welcome back. Hometown Alaska, my name is Charles Wolforth. I have two guests in the studio. Representative Eric Croft, former representative. I don't know quite what the right thing is. Mr. Croft.
Eric.
Honorable.
That's right. And Senator Liesl McGuire, who's headed back to Juneau for another term in the Alaska State Senate. And we're, of course, talking about what everybody's talking about, the election that's just passed. If you want to get involved, the number here is 550-8433. That's within Anchorage. The number from outside Anchorage is toll-free, 888-353-5752. And you can send us an email at hometownalaska@kska.org. I wanted to talk a little bit about the races that didn't get much attention. In fact, got an extraordinarily low amount of attention. I never remember a governor's race that got as small an amount of attention. And in terms of the U.S. House race, where you had a credible candidate, a former legislator running, virtually invisible and does very poorly in the outcome of the election. And then going down the ballot, the legislative races, again,
almost totally ignored.
Almost invisible, and you just sort of, they popped into view now and then when you saw a TV commercial, but in terms of the local media, nothing. And I guess, turning to you, Senator McGuire, since you just came out of this, your challenge was not that, I mean, you won by a large margin, but I'm sure you were running a campaign.
Yeah.
Is it harder to get attention now than it used to be?
Absolutely. I mean, this election cycle was just very difficult to get out any kind of dialogue about the state races. And I feel really badly for the folks that had contested races. I mean, frankly, power changed hands in the House of Representatives. It did. There were folks Mike Kelly, who'd served many years, who lost his race, and we don't know a whole lot about why. So I think it would have been a difficult race to come in if you didn't have any name ID. For example, I was real fortunate that I didn't have much of a race, and I had some name ID out there. But I think a disservice to Alaskans, too, and unfortunate with this outside money. It really, Eric pointed out earlier, unprecedented amount of money thrown into this election cycle. And I'm just not sure it served Alaskans well, because the airwaves, the TV were just infiltrated with these special interest groups telling us about the U.S. Senate race. We didn't get to focus on the head of state, our head of state, the most important position to us, and frankly, our state legislature and its makeup. Those state decisions are the things that are going to drive the next 50 years of Alaska's history. And certainly the federal government has an input and affects our future, but it's the state leaders that we really needed to focus on. You couldn't get a buy. I mean, you could not get a media buy. It was very difficult.
In other words, the airwaves were all sold out. There was nothing available.
They were all sold out. To get on the radio, Clear Channel and others, they weren't allowing state candidates on unless it was a third-party group. Radio, as you know, is one of those ways that you can actually take a shoestring budget and really stretch your message. So I'm not sure voters were served well this year.
Mm-hmm. It's the most significant problem, I think, in politics that we got to solve. And the Supreme Court decision really made it much, much worse. How you get the big money special interest out of politics. We're lucky, Liesl and I, to have grown up in our areas, know our district, and to some extent be able to knock on the doors once or twice through. That's a nice feeling that in bigger states they can't do. But you still, when we're inundated by this amount of money, after a while, interest groups figure out that it's cheaper than competing, better making a better mousetrap, right? Just beating the other company is to influence the political process to get you that result. And I'm really worried about that. I'm worried about sort of the excessive partisanship and what Liesl and Johnny Ellis and others have done in the Senate. You know, I hope the U.S. Congress and Senate takes that as a model. I don't think they will, but of cooperating, because that's where what most people want is that kind of cooperation.
It strikes me that there's another factor here, though, beyond just the paid advertising, which is only one part of a campaign, which is the sort of the local media attention. And, you know, we were told or expected that the internet was going to bring this great improvement for democracy, but it seems like it's driven our newspaper sort of down, and the information I get through the internet often is not of great quality. And so I'm not seeing the local news coverage of these races that we would have had in the past.
Absolutely, I would agree. And you're right, we thought that the internet would bring that Facebooking, Twitter, et cetera, but what it really does is bring more firsthand accounts, but they're very biased. Right. So if I'm writing about all the great things I think I'm doing, you're going to get that perspective, but you certainly don't have that 35,000-foot assessment of the race as a whole, what issues are playing out, and sometimes the unpleasant facts that have emerged in debates or other things. I agree.
Right, and the sort of the objective fact-checking. We have a question here from a caller. Keith, you had a question?
Yes. You there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, great. Well, the thing I was curious about is, did Liesl and Larry Palmer Anderson so they couldn't testify against each other with, you know, his corruption and who knows what she's been doing? And so I was kind of wondering which way the wind blew on that deal. I'll take my answers off there. Thank you.
I didn't understand the question. I say we move on to analysis of
results. I didn't have a question there unless you want to say something about it.
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to bring up anything. Frankly, when you put yourself out for public office, you have to be able to respond. And I'll respond simply by saying that Tom is my former husband. No, I did not marry him at all to not be able to participate in the investigation that he was undergoing. It's unfortunate. We choose people to love and marry, and they make mistakes sometimes. And in this case, as you and many Alaskans followed, what came out in the court is that I was not privy to a lot of a very separate life that Tom was living. And it's unfortunate. And but I appreciate the fact that Alaskans have the right to ask their elected leaders about their lives.
Okay, good answer. And you understood more of what he was saying than I did. I couldn't pick it up through the static. And either of you, maybe Eric, start with this one. We didn't see much about the Vico issue, the corruption issue. Don Young, I guess, had been, if not cleared, at least the Justice Department stopped investigating him.
It's a strange lowered standard, isn't it, when just
right.
They've dropped the charges is tantamount to innocence. Yeah, that was disappointing.
But I mean, there's less impact, and speaking to you as a Democrat, not that much impact in terms of our politics in Alaska because of this huge corruption investigation, these folks going to jail. And what do you make of that?
Obviously, I think there should be more. People need to be vigilant about the forces that will affect the campaigns, as we talked about. But the money will try and get there any number of ways. And if it can't get through campaigns, which it can, it goes through lobbyists or tries to go directly to politicians who will take that. It was disappointing. Serving down there when some of this was happening, you could tell that votes were odd. I don't know whether to be insulted that I was never, I would have, of course, refused if I'd been offered, but it's kind of like you would have liked to have been offered maybe and have the power to be indignant about it. But you saw odd votes, you saw votes change that were strange, and it was disappointing. I'm disappointed as an Alaskan and certainly as a member of the legislature. We need to have longer memories than that because those people who want to influence billion-dollar decisions, it's still worth their while to try and see if they can get somebody to take $100,000 to make a million or a billion.
Yeah. Let me turn to you, Liesl. And, you know, I just am, Ethan Berkowitz is known for that famous speech when he said, you know, this is our floor. And yet it doesn't seem to have done him a lot of good. What's your feeling on it?
Well, I would agree with Eric. I think the unfortunate thing, of course, the Ted Stevens case revealed, and we both know as lawyers, that you have to live up to the standards of justice if you're going to enforce rules. And unfortunately, there were improprieties that came out in that investigation. I think that did a lot to undermine the ultimate impact of the corruption investigation, because Alaskans were left wondering, who's more corrupt, the Department of Justice, the FBI, or in fact, VICO? That said, I would like to say that it has made an impact, and I think it's made an impact in a couple of very important ways. The first is that as a lawmaker who gets to serve now, without that cloud of the VICOs and others pressuring and sitting in the gallery and certainly pressuring more Republicans, I too never received a bribe or an offer of a bribe. It was never approached, and I didn't know later either whether to feel insulted or honored and so on. But that said, you did feel it. And as a Republican woman who doesn't believe in corruption, who thinks we have to have as influence-free of a government as possible, I feel relieved. That's the first change. The second change that is important is within the Republican Party. I think what you're seeing now is candidates that are out there running. We sort of cleaned house. And that's hard to say, because it's true that my former husband was a part of that group of folks that were cleaned out. But frankly, you do have to clean house every once in a while and wake up and realize that just because you belong to a group and you all have the same name behind the same letter behind your name on a ballot, it doesn't mean that you're necessarily subscribing to the same important values. And so I think that it has made a difference. I would agree that it wasn't at the forefront in the election, but it has made some important differences.
Yeah, thank you. I now want to turn to another guest that we're bringing on the show, Ivan Moore, who is a well-known public opinion researcher here in Anchorage, and also very experienced in working with the media. He's always a great guest to have on a radio show. Ivan, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Hey there, Charles. How are you?
We've raised expectations for you. You've got to be very entertaining.
That's right. We couldn't wait till you came on, Ivan.
Hey, Eric. Hey, Liesl. How are you?
Good.
So the polls in this top of the ballot race for U.S. Senate, we're all over the place. And it seemed like everyone was saying it was neck and neck going into the election day. And yet, fairly decisive outcome. Was that a late-breaking undecided group, or how do you analyze that race?
I think the trick there, Charles, was you had to be able to look at the polls individually and sort the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. There were some good polls that made sense, and then there were some polls that didn't make sense, and on closer inspection were clearly flawed. The main culprit was this PPP poll that came out on Monday, that was fielded on Saturday and Sunday by Public Policy Polling, which is a North Carolina outfit. It's an IVR polling firm. That's robo-calling. And it was suspect from the very beginning. I looked at the crosstabs of that thing. Joe Miller got 37% in that poll, and then Lisa and Scott McAdams were both tied at 30, which was completely counter to the previous most recent polls, which have been done by Dittman and Hallenthal, that seemed to show Joe Miller cratering somewhat and his vote dropping from the 30s down into the 20s. And the thing that really sold me on that PPP poll being wrong was race crosstab, white versus non-white. 70% of the sample was white, 30% of the sample was non-white, and the non-whites were voting 5% higher for Joe Miller than the whites were, which made absolutely no sense at all. It should have been 20 points lower. So you really had to look at that one and just throw it out. I think part of the other problem was that it was a robo-poll.
But it's tough for voters, isn't it? Because especially in an election like this where there's a lot of strategic voting, people saying, well, do I vote for Murkowski or McAdams? Depends on who's winning. Then the polls become part of the campaign.
Right, but there were consistencies. You know, obviously Scott McAdams' big problem was that he struggled to get out of third place in any of the polls that were done. Even going into Election Day, I thought his chances were pretty slim, but they were possible if all three of them were, huddled around 33%. There was a shot that Scott McAdams could win, but that was always his big problem, was being able to pull enough votes. And so the polls were funny, but I think if you looked at the ones that really made sense and fit in with the trend, it's the usual thing. If you look at trackers, you can tell which the outliers are, just pay attention to the ones that kind of fit in with the trend.
It was sort of this recursive problem for Scott. He couldn't win because they didn't think he could win. You know, if he
right.
he had to win before he could get there.
Well, I mean, yes and no. In that, you know, and the problem that I perceived for him after Lisa got in, and after the Alaskan Standing Together group formed, and it was clear that there was going to be a major, major effort to reel in the native vote for Lisa. That's a core constituency, on obviously, for a Democrat. And a Democrat running statewide, lucky to break into the 40s, will usually be stuck in the 30s. If they haven't got the native vote, they're down in the 20s, which is exactly where Scott
That's
ended.
Right. You need the native vote and moderate Republicans to win statewide as a Democrat. And if you're not going to get either with Lisa running... Yeah.
Well, you call them moderate Republicans, but most folks are independent or undeclared.
Yeah, undeclared and nonpartisan.
It seemed like that there was, just judging by the direct mail, my wife being a female, of course, and a teacher, there's a huge amount of focus on getting female voters for Murkowski or McAdams, and that those non-affiliated or Democratic women were a real prize here. What are your thoughts on the demographics of this whole race, Ivan?
You know, I didn't really think about it from that perspective. I have a hard time putting myself in a woman's head. Maybe Lisa will be better equipped to speak to that. I really thought about it just from the point of view of party affiliation. And what people's ideology was. obviously, the Democrats would go largely for... Scott McAdams. I figured even with his cratering, the majority of Republicans would go with Joe. And then, of course, Lisa had the biggest base of all with the moderates in the middle, who comprise, you know, 40% of the population, which was what she ended up getting vote-wise. And that's where she dominated, and that's what I think was, you know, the driving issue. More than demographics like gender and age and whatever else.
Well, thank you, Ivan. And from my perspective, there definitely was an undercurrent of women supporting women. And I guess I could just say you're privy to it as a women leader in a way probably that you aren't. It's an undercurrent. It's not something people aren't out burning their bras anymore, but they sort of are in their speech and in their thoughts. And I think there was a certain amount of feeling, particularly when you think of the contrast of a Joe Miller. Not so much in Scott McAdams, clearly a much more welcoming, moderate candidate. But I can't tell you the number of women that said to me at their door, without saying names to reveal privacy, but they just didn't like the feeling they had about Joe Miller. They couldn't put their finger on it. It was an unnerving feeling that threatened them as a woman. Very interesting.
Right. Yes, and I think you're right in that, you know, if you look at the 35% of people who supported Joe Miller, you'd probably find that the majority of them are men. But it's not going to be some 80-20. It's tops 60-40, which means that the majority of the people that are tussling between Lisa, you know, those people who are trying to toss up whether to vote for Lisa or Scott McAdams, like my wife, for example, who's a registered Democrat, was agonizing for weeks over this thing. really, you've got a situation where the majority of those people are women because Joe Miller's got majority men. But then you've got this competing dynamic where, yes, the women voters are more likely to go with Lisa because she's a woman, but the women voters are also more likely to go with Scott McAdams because he's the more liberal choice. And men tend to be more conservative and women tend to be more liberal. So it tends to cancel out you know, be equal in that respect.
And how do you size up Joe Miller from here on out? I know he has high negative ratings in the polls. On the other hand, he finished a three-way race with 35%. Do you think he has a future in Alaska politics?
No. I don't think so.
Minimum 35 and maximum 35.
Not running statewide, no.
And why is that? Just because of too many?
I think he just did far too much broad damage to himself.
So what does that mean for Sarah Palin? Is she done in terms of her ability to endorse? I mean, is she a kiss of death because of that kind of percentage?
Well, I always kind of maintained, you know, from when I was asked by the press back when the primary was still going on and everyone was wondering, what did Joe Miller have a chance and so on and so forth. And people were asking, you know, what is the effect of Sarah Palin's endorsement? Does she have a sway kind of with her telling people to vote for Joe? And I always said at the time, you know, in a Republican primary, yeah, absolutely. But once she gets into the general, I mean, Sarah's in a situation where her negative is up over 50% now. We are a long, long time removed from the old halcyon days where her positive rating was a notch over 90% statewide. Those days are gone. And she's now in a situation where, roughly speaking, she's 40 favorable, 50 unfavorable.
Not a good place to be.
And, you know, when people endorse other people, what you typically want is someone doing the endorsing who's pretty darn popular. I mean, look, you don't have to look any further than Lisa Murkowski, who always had Ted Stevens doing her endorsements when she ran, this time included. And you, anytime you're in a situation, not everyone who likes the endorser is necessarily going to be positively influenced. And obviously you have to remember that the people who are negatively disposed to the endorser will have a negative effect on the endorsement. So, you know, you've got to be careful with it. And really, the person needs to be pretty popular. And Sarah, kind of outside of a Republican primary, is looking at a situation where our numbers are not good enough anymore.
Well, Ivan Moore, I want to really thank you for being with us today. Ivan Moore of Ivan Moore Research. You can find him, I believe, in the Anchorage Press.
Yes, that's right. Coming out tomorrow.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, you guys. Good chatting.
Great. And we have a bunch of phone calls. I don't know if we'll get through them all and some emails. But first, I'd like to go to Dennis, who's been waiting on the line, I think, to talk about the bonds. Dennis?
Yes. I was wondering if you could mention the bond issues and the constitutional amendment.
Sure. Well, there were.
I haven't heard anything about them.
All right. Well, there were
HFC bond that was sort of uniformly popular for veterans. That was going to pass and did pass.
That was giving mortgages, money for mortgages for veterans, and there's an educational bond, which was for rural schools and also for the state archives. That passed with 60% approval.
Yep. Which, before you move off that, I mean, in a election that was supposedly a landslide on fiscal issues, we still approved a pretty big bond package. And I guess I was worried about that one with its size hanging out there. So I don't think it's so easy to summarize the mood of the electorate. But go ahead.
That was what I was wondering about, if they both passed.
Yep.
Kind of. What are people thinking?
Mm-hmm. Hard to you know, in a way, hard to really guess what people are thinking in terms of the spread of how they voted. You know, Sean Parnell, certainly no Tea Party candidate. He's a very down the middle of the road, you know, sensible kind of guy, which I kind of guess also says bonds. And he must have. Now, on the ballot measure number one, which was to increase the size of the legislature with the intent, I believe, of protecting rural Alaska after redistricting takes place, that failed 60% no, 40% yes. I assume because nobody really knew what it was or why it was on the ballot.
Why it was, and I don't think there was a big enough a job of selling it. If you're going to have more politicians, you really got to justify it, and they didn't. I mean, redistricting is coming up, and rural areas are going to lose, native areas are going to lose representation. It's going to move to the Kenai, Matsu, a little bit to Anchorage. And that's problematic because you're running up against traditional areas where there would be two Yupik seats and an Inupiat and a Tlingit Haida and an Athabascan. And when that shrinks another notch, that you're having to blur a lot of traditional distinctions, and it's disturbing. I wanted to mention one thing. I know we're running out of time.
I think Lisa had a comment.
Okay, just real quickly, and I concur with Eric. The other place that'll be impacted is Southeast Alaska.
Yeah.
They're going to lose a seat too. But I do think that people in that first sentence where it said expanding the size of the legislature did go to their inner beliefs about the legislature being big enough, powerful enough, et cetera, et cetera, and without any group out there explaining what the the loss would be to the state, it didn't stand a chance.
Yeah. Did you have another comment here?
Well, an associated change, I think. Well, the House is House minority down to about 12 with some rural Democrats that joined the majority and may join it again. The real big change, I think, over and when I was first elected in 96, there was about that size minority. That is, Democrats were about 12, and then there were some swing rural Democrats at that time, too. But it was an overwhelmingly rural or non-Anchorage minority. The big shift, I think, is it's an overwhelmingly Anchorage and Fairbanks minority. And the coalition or majority in the House is where the rural representation is. This is the first time, I think, in last history, it'll depend on what Neil Foster does, that you'd have the Democratic side of the aisle have nobody from rural Alaska. Mm-hmm. And so that's been a gradual shift over the last 10 years. I think it means that the minority can be a little more focused on Anchorage issues or sort of middle class or business issues, but it's a shift that has been going on and changes things. Liesl's in a majority that has both rural and urban aspects to it. I think that's probably a healthier situation.
Yeah. Thanks for your question, Dennis. That was a lot of answer for a quick question. I'm going to go to another caller now. Lucy is calling from Anchorage with a question about campaigns what was your question, Lucy?
Thank you, Charles. I live both in Bethel and Anchorage, and winter in Anchorage and summer in Bethel. That's where I'm from. My question is, do you see a need for, I said, policies or regulations that might correct half-truths, outright lies on campaign times? And let me just say that I asked this question because I thought it was so sad across the nation. It looked like it was a division of society. I mean, encouraging divisions in society. There were some really sad things going on, and I watched them on C-SPAN, too, across the nation.
Yeah, thanks for that question.
Tea parties and Republicans and both Democrats and church leaders.
We only have a couple of minutes left, so let me turn that to my guests.
It's disturbing.
Is there anything we can do about it? And Senator McGuire, any thoughts?
Thank you. Lucy, thank you for your question and your remarks. And I think you echo the sentiments of a lot of Alaskans about both the national elections and our own state elections. You know, we talk about this. We have the First Amendment, and the First Amendment is interpreted very broadly when it comes to public speech and the right of people to say it and the right of people to say it about public officials in particular. There's a very famous case, the New York Times v. Sullivan case, that says that you have to prove not only is it not factual, but you said it with malice. It's a very high standard to correct these things. But I agree with you, the civility went way down in our state, in our nation. And I don't know what we can do about it other than try to encourage and foster better speech. And I think Eric hit on one thing earlier we can think about is to what extent we allow outside organizations to speak so often and really cloud the issues. But I don't know what law could change that, Eric.
Yeah, it's horrible.
And I'm afraid we're out of time. I'd love to hear your answer. We got to do this again sometime. I really want to thank Senator Liesl McGuire and Representative Eric Croft and my other guests, Senator Begich, Lieutenant Governor Campbell, and Ivan Moore. It's been a fascinating discussion, and I apologize to those callers who didn't get on the air and the emailers. We'll try to get you next time. Next week on Hometown Alaska, host Kathleen McCoy will talk about winter and get an Alaska Native look at what's in store. That's Hometown Alaska, November 10th on KSKA next week, next Wednesday. Thanks for tuning in.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program, additional information, and links to all the websites mentioned on today's show are available online at kska.org. Send us your comments and suggestions of things you'd like to talk about at Hometown Alaska, 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. This is KSKA Anchorage.